Okay, so now I'm beginning the recording. I'll just say the date for the recording is the 19th of January, 2019. Very nice. We've just read Deuteronomy 2:31, and we stopped, or we should have stopped, at verse 23 of chapter 3. Who was here last week? About half of you. So last week, Gary drew a map on the board, which is very helpful for those of us who don't spend all our time reading these texts. Should just keep in mind where the different people groups were, how the children of Israel were coming up into the land. So I hope you have in your mind that map. If not, some of you have maps in your Bibles. It would have to be not a massive map of the whole area, but one of specifically Israel, and specifically the people groups on the other side of the Jordan. It's interesting in this selection, we were reading stories that we've already read, right? Do you remember when we read about Sihon and Og? And who are Sihon and Og? What is special about them, let's say?
Well, Og is the Golan, Bashan, up on the Golan,
yeah,
up on the north. So it's part of Hermon. I'm never quite clear where
Ramat HaGolan.
It's Ramat HaGolan.
Yeah.
So is it which side, technically, which side of the Jordan is it?
East. It's on the eastern ridge up there.
Right.
But the text here says above the Ammonites. Where did it say that? If you notice, what has been the pattern as the children of Israel come into the land? Who can they fight and whom can they not fight? What do you remember?
Well, what's clear here is that they can only fight the ones that God tells them they can fight.
Right, that's clear. And
everybody.
So anybody who is currently in the land that is promised to them, they're going to fight. People that are not in the land promised to them, they may not fight at all. And so who does that include?
Is he the one that made the borders?
What are you talking about?
He's the one that told people to fight the inheritance of Esau.
Esau. Okay, so Esau, which is what country? What's the other name of Esau?
Edom.
Right, so you don't fight Edom. Who else? Moab. Well, that's the interesting thing. You also don't fight Moab to take it over. They did have a battle at Beit Peor, but that was over foreign worship. There was some type of bad stuff going on.
Is that Lot's sons?
Lot's sons?
It says, well, Lot
didn't have sons. He had daughters.
Okay.
Yeah, he had sons through his daughters. I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Yes. So Lot's relatives, Moab and Ammon. Now, who of you remembers back when we read through Numbers? What if any, are the differences between the Numbers telling of this story of Sihon and Og and Menashe, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and here?
Can we look?
Sure.
Where is it?
There is Numbers 32, verse 28 to 42.
32? Numbers 22?
No, 32. Did I start in verse 22? Goes all the way up to verse 42. You can skip around in there. I mean, 28 to 42, it's a pretty fairly big chunk.
There's a big, what strikes me is there's a big difference between the Deuteronomy account of today, where God has said you're to do this, this, and this, and he only gives them permission to do it. And here it feels much more likely that Moses is saying it. Almost like Moses
here
has got the authority.
In Deuteronomy, you're saying?
In Numbers.
Oh, in Numbers.
In Numbers, it's Moses who's saying, do this, this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
He gave the command to the priest, and so on.
Well, in Numbers also, we had the tribes ask for it.
The tribe?
The Menashe. Some of the tribes said, hey, we have so much cattle, this is such good land, can't we just stay here? And then he brings it before the Lord, and the Lord says, yes. So it's interesting to me because it seems a bit like a concession. Like there's the original boundary of the promised land, and then, okay, we'll include this little finger over here too.
So it's God who gives the concession.
Yes. But once it's been deemed promised land, then you need to do the same as you do to the rest of the promised land to it, lest you be led astray by foreign worship. It's interesting to me because as I read the borders of the promised land, I mean, this is a huge, big, sticky issue, right? And it, depending what time frame you're looking at or who's, where in the Bible you're looking at, there can be tweaks in the border. But the way I see it, it's a very long, skinny selection of land. And remember in the Bible, you're facing east. So when it says this land is rachavat yadayim, it's wide, open space of the arms. I would see that going north-south, very long space north-south. But basically, you stop when you come to the River Jordan. Moab and Midian on the other side, that's not the promised land. And if you remember the story of Lot and Abraham, Abraham said, they're looking out towards the east, and he said, if you go right, I'll go left, which is south and north. If you go south, I'll go north. If you go north, I'll go south. So the presupposition is this promised land is north-south, this little strip. And Lot's like, never mind north-south, I'm going to go east. I'm just going to go in that little
green valley,
which is not actually even, in the way that the author's telling this story, Lot is going outside of the promised land. So it's very interesting that this promised land is such a little narrow strip down this whole thing. But if you follow it up north, it does say it will extend all the way to the what river? Do you remember?
Euphrates.
And if you go way up north, there is a leg of the Euphrates that comes in closer. So I don't think that the author would be saying, you know, from like where Moab is on the map. We're going to need a little bit of a map here.
I think somebody just showed me that Tim Ogrok has the whole of Israel to the Euphrates on the background of the temple.
Oh, yeah? Well, here's the thing. Okay, I'm not going to attempt to do this, but I'm going to try here. Let's say Israel's here, like Israel we know, right? Like that? And here's the Euphrates coming up like that? I don't think when it says all the way to the Euphrates, it's talking about here, all the way to Euphrates, you know, Jordan, Iraq, la la la. I think because it can't include this place. That's not promised land.
No.
So what, is he going to jump all the way to the Euphrates? I think it means this whole strip all the way to the Euphrates is here. Because he starts describing north and then all the way to the Euphrates. And who lived up here? This is Aram in the Bible, Syria, or, you know, it kind of gets all mixed together. Who was from Haran?
Abram.
Abram. And Abram's whole family was up here. And so right kind of behind this river Euphrates.
So in a sense, he's getting back to the land he came from.
Yeah, all the way up to, but not quite there. Yeah. So maybe Euphrates is that borderline. So when it says all the way to the Euphrates, don't think like all the way there.
think up and down from the south to the north, and as you're going north, all the way to the Euphrates, up in this corner. Anyway, that's just to say, this side of the Dead Sea is not the Promised Land. However, there is this finger that goes into there. And the finger is what allows Menashe to be on one side and the other.
So where's Menashe on this map?
On this map? On my crazy map? Let's see. Okay, so if this is the Sea of Galilee, Menashe would be on this side of the Jordan River and that side, and then up. Right? Because it goes into Ramat HaGolan.
Right.
And, yes.
Yeah, but I think the Promised Land in that time, in that time, there is no meaning of the boundary.
There's no meaning of the boundary?
No meaning of border, borderline. Yeah, that is not the meaning of borderline. It is the meaning of the where you can get your children, descendants, continue to survive. So in that time, to the eastern side, then it's very poor. Probably.
It's very poor.
It's not a good place to let their children to be.
I don't think it's poor on the eastern side.
Dry, maybe.
Well, it is
drier.
Okay, here down here.
Opposite.
Down here, you're right, but we're talking about.
I'm not talking about literally. Like, we're talking about that huge swath of.
No.
The Arabian Desert, I'm talking about.
Desert.
Yeah, the desert is not so productive. But the point you're talking about here for Manasseh in the Bashan, this whole area, Ramat HaGolan, it's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Very good for cows.
And then even north.
And north, yes. It's a good land for cows.
So I think that in that time, the Promised Land, the meaning of Promised Land or the fighting direction, should be to the area which is more
good.
Productive.
Okay, so you're saying that the Promised Land would be defined according to what would be more productive, basically.
I guess so. I'm not sure.
It's flowing, what you know.
Well, okay, it's interesting because the Promised Land is defined often as the land flowing with milk and honey.
Yeah.
And when you think about it,
is that cow giving milk?
God is an optimist. Because if it's flowing with milk and honey, yeah, those are blessings. But that means I don't hear anything about grain, you know? And you think a lot about this land. There's a lot of places here. It's hard to grow grain because you have a bunch of hills in areas that have good rainfall. And then in the Negev, it doesn't have good rainfall. And you have some more open areas. But so it's not like...
It's like the grain where they make the honey.
It's not like Egypt and Assyria where you have these large open areas and very good for grain growing. So it's interesting. It's a promised land. God's telling you what you can get out of this land. But it's never going to be like a superpower for mass food production. It's not that type of land. But we do have miraculous, when Isaac chooses to stay in the land and obey God, he gets a miraculous harvest of grain. So it's definitely a land where your produce is directly dependent on God. Like, God has to send the rain. There's no major river. There's no kind of stable, inherent thing about the land that you could just count on. You are very much dependent on God.
Wouldn't the promise be
God.
Where God sent Abraham? He said, go to that land. Go down.
He did.
Kind of
but he also sent him to Eretz Canaan. There was already kind of a conceptual area that was... Within that area, walk around in it, and I'll give you everything your foot steps on. And it's interesting, Abram always follows the north-south route.
Yeah.
He doesn't then go crazy into Moab or something. He does go down to Egypt, but he wasn't supposed to, if you read between the lines.
I'm not sure if that is the reason of the mountain. I mean,
what
the
mountain?
Hill, the hill. Yeah, because of the eastern side, then that would be the desert. So no green. When there is no green, there will be no milk and no honey.
There'll be no milk and no honey when there's no green? Yeah. We have a...
There's actually the east is full of water. The east, especially in the Jordan Valley, if you've ever driven down.
Oh, yes, they're there.
Yeah.
On the eastern side of the Jordan, it's much more water in the Jordan Valley. And you get to the, when the clouds come in across, they drop their rains at the watershed
line
of the Judean Belt and Samaria. And then it skips over the Jordan Valley. And then in the plateaus, it once again gets, there's plentiful water up there.
Yeah.
But in that time, in that situation, the Jordan kingdom exists already.
Right.
Which means that, does it mean that God will give places where belongs to already to a kingdom already then to the promised people?
Here's the deal. We see different reactions based on what is considered the promised land. So the kingdom of Moab, God said, don't dispossess them. But the kingdom of Og and Sihon, he said, yes. So if it's defined as promised land, yes, dispossess them. If it's not, Moab and Ammon are not considered promised land, then you may not dispossess them, even though their land is very good. And Edom, I mean, Edom is also, I mean, it's more arid, but it's considered a strong kingdom. It's fortified. It has mountain fortresses. They have a lot of copper, you know, Nehoshet productivity. So none of these places are bad. It's not that God said, oh, that land isn't good enough, so don't capture. It's just what is defined as promised land and what is not.
I will say that if we understand it in this way, then it means that when God said the promised land, that it refers to a certain area.
Yes.
But why it is begun to the other people? Because you did not obey the land's direction. You go to the Egypt, you do whatever God do not tell you to do. No?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand that. But let's focus more on the text we have, because we're going a little far afield.
Okay.
What is important, I think, when Moses is retelling this story, he's emphasizing certain things. And so you get the information that because this is now defined as a promised land, whether or not it was originally intended to be, God then said, yes, Menashe should live here. Now it's promised land. Therefore, you need to get rid of all the inhabitants because they would otherwise lead you astray. And it's interesting, they use the word metim. Have you ever heard the word metim? Mete me'at. Does that ring a bell for anybody?
Like a brush or something.
Mete me'at. If you do a Passover seder. We went down to Egypt, we were just a few men, or a few people. It's a rare word for saying men, and it uses that. They wiped out the men, women, and children. It uses that same word. It's a very rare word for saying men. You can find it in the book of Job a couple times.
Mem
tet yud. Wait, actually, no, it's a mem tav. Rega. Where is the other interesting thing? I can't see my verse right now. The other interesting thing is that in David's day, I remember there also being territorial takeovers in this area too. David had control of this area in his day as well. So that's interesting that when Deuteronomy is giving you information, it happens to line up with information that was relevant in the first kingdom, in David and Solomon's time. We talked about Deuteronomy being a sermon. What is Moses' main point about this? Why does he bring up that they conquered Sihon and Og? What is his idea? First of all, what else do you know about Og and Sihon? What's significant about them, besides where they live?
They were very large. They were giants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're
so
giants.
In other words, in the beginning, he gave them more confidence and hope that
right.
they could do it.
So under Moses' direction, they were able to take down two giant kings. They were the last remaining Rephaim. And so they go into describing this huge bed. Why does it need to be so huge? Because the king's a giant, right? And so if Moses can take down two giants, you know, the rest of you can do the same thing later on. And you definitely have this idea of handing on the torch to Joshua. And what are the two commands that we saw in the previous, I don't know about last week, the week before? We've seen it several times in Moses' sermon. There are two things he keeps saying. Do not be afraid. Take heart, be courageous. And what's the other one? Why should you not be afraid?
Because the Lord is with you.
The Lord is with you, or the Lord will fight for you. There you go. That's another key phrase. And in the Hebrew, what verse is that? I'm going completely off of memory this morning. Okay. The Lord will fight for you. Here, my translation says, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God will personally fight for you. Verse 22 of chapter 3, Deuteronomy. And that's really where you were saying the parasha ends. Ki Adonai Eloichem, hu hanilcham lechem.
God himself fights for you.
Right. So if you just want to say God is fighting for you, the natural order would just be Elohim nilcham lechem. You're not emphasizing anything. But when you say Ki Adonai Eloichem, hu hanilcham lechem, you're saying he's the one fighting for you as opposed to someone else or as opposed to yourselves. So there is some emphasis. The Lord is fighting for you. And then we have, did you say, wait, where are we going to stop?
In 23, if you stop.
Okay. In my prep, I went too far. Okay, so we're going to leave that for the next week. So that really, to me, is the summary of this whole retelling of the conquest. Those are the main points that Moses is trying to get into your mind. And with that, we want to break into Joshua 10:22. Let's look over there and see why these two places were combined in people's readings. Okay, who would like to read? Somewhere down there, wherever we stop, you can continue.
Then Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave. And they did so and brought out those five kings to them from the cave. The king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmuk, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. So it was when they brought out those kings to Joshua, and Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage. For thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And afterward Joshua struck them and killed them and hanged them on five trees. And they were hanging on the trees until evening.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Okay. So, it's interesting. In our parasha, it started out, and the Lord started to give them the victory. And he said, start going out and inheriting the land. So, in Deuteronomy, when they are capturing the that whole area, this little finger on the other side, or not exactly a finger, it starts on the east side and goes up to the north of the Lake of Galilee, that is considered the beginning of conquest, even though it's happening on the other side of the Jordan. But the text repeats itself. You're starting, you're starting, you're starting. And here, what do you get? What did we hear?
Even in terms of these five kings, I mean, these five kings, presumably, I was trying to read back and see who they were and hidden themselves in Makeda.
Mm-hmm.
But what were these guys doing?
In verse 20, it says, and it was when Joshua and the children of Israel finished to strike them, a great strike. So it's kind of like bookends. You know, they're finishing to wipe them. They're from Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmut, Lachish. It's kind of a very broad group here of five kings. Not, you know, Hebron and Jerusalem, all these people, they're not on the east side of the Jordan, they're on the west side.
And where's Jarmut?
Yeah, Lachish is Philistine territory, kind of south and to the ocean from us. Of course, Jerusalem, Hebron on the main watershed line. Eglon, Yarmut.
There still is an Eglon, isn't there?
Probably.
But I'm still trying to work out why these kings were used as a sort of show and tell example of what will happen to the enemies. What have they hidden from Joshua in this cave, right?
Right. Because they're fleeing. They're losing the battle. So
they're losing the battle. So they're fleeing from... Joshua's trying to take the land.
Right.
And he's pretty successful before.
They flee. They go to a quite massive cave.
Right.
And he brings them out as a testimony of this is what's going to happen to all your enemies. So maybe you could say these five are representative of many different areas of the land.
Right.
And what
also representative, presumably, of the sort of power or authority or whatever Israel has or Joshua has or God is going
right.
to say, this is what's going to happen to our enemies.
Notice Joshua's words, though, as a leader, what does he say first? When he pulls them out and everybody's putting their foot on their necks, what does Joshua say?
Don't be afraid and don't be discouraged.
So the same things that began in Deuteronomy, in Moses' words.
Instead
of being afraid and discouraged, you should be strong and courageous because
the Lord is with you.
The Lord will fight for you.
Exactly. This is what the Lord will do to all your enemies. So again, he's trying to emphasize this is not our battle, and this is not just something we want to do. This is only happening if God's in it. If God doesn't do it, it doesn't happen.
Well, we have to ask God first.
Absolutely.
Can we go on and fight? Will
absolutely. And if he says no, you better not.
Right.
And of course, why does he hang them until evening?
An example.
But why only till evening? Deuteronomy 20, where it says anyone left up hanging is considered cursed. So you bring them down by nightfall and presumably bury them or do something with them. Here he threw it into the cave. He threw it into the same cave that they were hiding in before. So in a sense, it's poetic justice.
It's like hang on his own petard. It's like a story.
Yes. Okay, so why were these two places connected?
The two passages.
These two passages, yeah.
Because it's the same message, which is basically only do what the Lord tells you to do and be strong because he will have the victory.
Yeah.
Is that
absolutely. I mean, that's the things that pop out dominantly to me. Let's see what the rest adds to us. Let's jump to Habakkuk 3:11 and say, why would they go there?
Isn't that the thing? when the fig tree blossoms?
No. Let me make sure it's the same in English. Yeah, 3:11. Good. So this is Habakkuk is a poet, and most prophecy is poetry, and he's describing the Lord's battles with people. And he says, what does he say? Who has it? Who would like to read it?
Verse 11.
Yes.
Till when?
Till it stops.
Okay. Sun and moon stood still in the heavens at the glint of your flying arrows, at the lightning of your flashing spear. In wrath you strode through the earth, and in anger you threshed the nations. You came out to deliver your people, to save your anointed one. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness. You stripped him from head to foot. With his own spear you pierced his head, when his warriors stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour the wretched who were in hiding. You trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. I heard, and my heart pounded. My lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled. Yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. Though the fig tree does not bud,
there's your verse, Gemma.
And there are no grapes on the vine, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stores, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Saviour. The Sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to go on the heights for the director of music on my stringed instruments.
Okay. So, Habakkuk is living at a time, basically, when he doesn't see what he expects to see. Everything's actually pretty depressing. So he's recounting God's glories from the past. And maybe we start in verse 11. What does it remind you of when you hear about sun and moon standing still in their courses?
Well, like Joel last week as well.
What?
That's
yeah.
Joshua.
So it's interesting in these connections, these two are connected, but now this is actually connected with this. It's kind of being woven, right? Because it has a connection to Joshua and the battle in Ayalon. And so he's describing God's great deliverances, but you can see from the last verses that they're not seeing God's great deliverances in his day. What are they seeing?
The fig tree not blossoming.
Yeah, the fig tree not blossoming. That means there's no water, right? Figs find water, they go deep. No grapes on the vine, that's pretty bad. The olive trees aren't producing. The fields aren't producing. There are no sheep. There are no cattle. So it sounds like quite a drought. Sounds like quite hard times. But what?
He's going to rejoice.
He's going to rejoice because God's going to deliver him. Basically, he's waiting. He's waiting for God to deliver him. So it's the same principle that we saw of God's fighting for you. Like, even when you don't see it, you wait for it. You believe in it. You know it's going to happen at some point.
And
so,
the Lord God is my strength.
Yes.
That's physical strength. You'll make my feet like deer's feet, but it's also spiritual or emotional.
It's yeah, you could say it's all the above. So it's almost kind of like you see the bookends again. You see the before, like rah, 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 be strong. You see the during, and you see the absence of, or the after, or what's going on, God, why isn't this happening? And yet in each situation, the answer is, God is my strength. God is going to fight for me. I just have to wait. I have to not just wait that you're doing nothing, but expect that it will happen and that God is able to make it happen. And then you're fine. When you don't see it, you still hold on to that expectation. So that's kind of, does anyone else see a connection between Habakkuk 3 and this that we've missed?
Or, as you say, it's woven in through here to here?
Or should we go to Amos?
And the only we didn't point out is that verse 16 is a real anxiety.
Verse 16,
when I heard my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, everything seemed terrible. I mean, that's what you're saying, but it's poetically written, but
No, there is real anxiety here.
There's real anxiety. And when he comes up to the people, he'll invade them with his troops. So when these enemies come against you.
Or when natural problems, natural disasters come against you as well. In both situations, you're totally dependent on God to deliver.
I was just connecting it with the Deuteronomy passage, which is more about, less about natural disasters.
And more about
and more
enemies.
More about the enemies and the nations and the...
And the giants
which
you face.
The giants and which land belongs to you and which does not belong to you and whatever.
Right, absolutely. So in Amos 2, verse 9, let's just read that. Amos 2, 9 takes a little bit, it's emphasizing this in a different way. Ve'anochi hishmadeti et ha'emori. And I destroyed the Amorites from before them, who were as tall as what?
Cedars.
It's pretty tall. And as strong as oaks. So what could this be referring to?
Giants with their steel beds.
Sure, it can easily refer to giants. Of course, we have a lot of imagery. You remember the king of Israel talking to the king of Judah, saying, the little thorn brush came to the cedar, and he was referring to himself as a cedar. So these metaphors can refer to both military power and strength, or they can refer to the kings themselves, who maybe their own stature is symbolic of their country, being just dominantly strong. And here he says, God says, I'm the one that took those people down, even though they were as strong as this and as tall as that. And he continues this metaphor. I wiped them out, including their fruit above and their roots below. So, I don't know how you want to take that. It would be their descendants. And then he goes back in time in verse 10. I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I led you through the wilderness for 40 years so you could take the Amorites' land as your own. What do you hear here? Who is the enemy in these verses? Amorites. So that's interesting. That kind of connects us up to Deuteronomy. Because that's one of his favorite words when he's looking for a word to define all of the inhabitants in Canaan that God dispossessed, because we know there were many different people groups, Deuteronomy tends to call them Amorites. He calls them Canaanites too, but a lot of times Amorites. And so here, that kind of, he's also talking about the Amorites.
Yeah, but Amos goes on, doesn't he?
He does.
He really begins to rebuke Israel now.
Yes.
But... I gave the Nazarites
and prophets.
And what did you do is you gave them wine to drink and commanded the prophets saying, Don't prophesy,
yeah. And so then what's the response? What is God going to do then?
Impression.
He's going to press them. He uses a very interesting word. Here I'm going to ma'ik. Me'ik tachtechem ka'asher ta'ik ha'agala hamle'a la'amir. He uses some nice verse 13. Here's some nice eins there. It's a bit of a automatopoeia, a word that kind of sounds like what it will do. And because of that, your refuge is going to be taken from you, nowhere to run away to. All your fast runners are going to die too. Yeah. So it's interesting. So he starts with a historical aspect, and then he turns it around on its head and saying, but what's gone wrong?
They didn't hear us say they weren't obedient. They didn't do what they said or mm-hmm. he told them to do.
Yeah, basically blatant disregard.
Because
the Nazarites were the ones not supposed to drink.
And the prophets were supposed to prophesy.
Right. And so, you know, again, this connection, if you break your promise, then you're going to get some consequences. Right. And so...
it's like us today. God only asks us to be obedient, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
It's true. He doesn't ask us to be successful. We might be.
Right.
But he demands obedience.
Right.
Trust and obey. There's no other way.
So what other connections do you see between this Jonah passage and our starting point?
Well, it's again a recap on this thing about be strong in the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Because if your strength is in the Lord, yes, you will escape, you will do anything. But if you're disobedient and you do whatever, whether
right.
it's giving wine to the Nazarites or telling your prophets not to prophesy or not listening, then you haven't got the strength. You've got no security. The most courageous men of might shall flee naked in that day. I mean, you're just running for your life.
Right.
Because there's nobody with you.
Now, these words in Amos, they're in the context of what? Do you remember? Now, Amos, he's from the south, right? He's from
right.
Tekoa. And he goes up north in a time, in the time of Jeroboam, which was like the heyday next to Solomon. The northern kingdom was having a boom. And so it's easy when you're successful in life to assume that God's blessing me, right?
Yeah.
And so Amos's main word is, don't interpret this blessing to be God condoning your actions. No. But it's interesting because he starts off with a prophecy against the nations where everybody's, you know, oh, yeah, yeah, God's going to take those people down. He's going to take those people down. Good, good. Those people down. And Amos is going around, and then he zeroes in, and the punchline is, and I'm going to take you down because you did this, speaking to Israel and Judah. So that's another little interesting flip, because the beginning of the nation prophecies takes us back to here, like, oh, yeah, yeah, if God's with us, who could be against us? And yeah, God's going to take down our enemies, and isn't that great? And then Amos kind of flips it, saying, like, true, I'm going to judge them. And true, I did all these great things to the giants in the past, but I can do the same things to you for the same reason. And so it's kind of like a very pointed reversal. And it would have a big shock effect.
And not very popular. Yeah,
and not very popular.
It also strikes me that it's so not normal for just human thought. I mean, we see over and over again how once you're in a position, you just hammer down everyone else. Like,
yeah.
You would think, you know, oh, you suffered, you would know, but it never works that way.
And once you're in the up position, you assume you deserve it. That's the interesting thing.
And if you like use the same measures that were once evil and just horrific, you just do them too. And
right.
Here God's it's this word from outside and above that can say evil is evil.
Yeah.
No matter where it's found. Like,
right.
You just because you're my people doesn't mean
you're exempt from
the top dog.
Yeah. And it's interesting, if you read through the book of Amos, the evil he describes, you know, some of it is blatant, like everyone would agree with, just kind of like moral, don't commit adultery or don't do this or that. But a lot of it is social injustice. You know, it's the fact that you're rich, not that it's sinful to be rich, but if you're rich because you are oppressing the workers underneath you, yes, it is a sin. And so those kind of evils are more subtle, and I think they are more relatable in our world because a lot of the world we live in, the money is, I mean, there is power in weapons, but true power is in money, and it's a whole economical system, and it's that very system that can be the oppressive part. Like, you constantly have to be evaluating whether you're part of the problem. You know, are you oppressing people by your system? Are you getting rich off of somebody else being mistreated? And you can never just kind of, the end justifies the means, where, yeah, we're promised this land, or we're the people of God, therefore we can do what we want here. There's, like you said, there's never a carte blanche, what do you call it?
Carte blanche.
Carte blanche, that's how you say it. Get out of jail free card if you play Monopoly. All right, so
you don't see, that's the irony, is that you don't see injustice, even though you, from a position of power, even though it should be easiest to see it. You have to train your eye. You have to constantly take yourself out of your comfort zone and ask yourself, what would it feel like to be in someone else's shoes?
Yeah.
And what would it feel like to be that person? And what would it feel like to be a poor person, a person of another race, a person of another this, another that? It's a discipline.
Yeah. And when God is defining, he says, I'm going to come oppress you guys, the way, basically implying the way you've been doing it to other people. In verse 13 and 14. And the place of refuge is going to be lost to the person who is normally swift, normally a fast runner. You think of people on the battlefield that are really quick. And the strong one, that's Hazak, is not going to be brave, or is not going to be able to rally his strength. And it's using the same words, Hazak ve'ematz, that Moses tells Joshua, and Joshua tells the people, be strong and courageous. And he's like, yeah, all you strong people out there, you're not going to be courageous. You're not going to have strength. And the gibor is not going to be able to run away. And so it's exactly that, of like reversing this strength. Of like, yeah, be strong and courageous as long as you understand that your strength is coming from God. The minute you forget that that's the case and you just think you deserve it, whatever, then God's going to take that very strength and reverse it on you. Mm-hmm. So
it's linked, isn't it, to what Brenda just said, because they've despised the law of the Lord and not kept his commandments.
Right.
So if you're not living in obedience to him on whatever level we're talking about, you know, in terms of one's relationship with the Lord, whether it's whatever.
So this idea of strength and courage, there has to be self-critique of your own strength and courage constantly. If you're in a position of power, you need to be constantly critiquing yourself and making sure that you understand that your power is coming from God, and that, like, you're aligning yourself with God. You're not trying to just use God, or kind of like taking God's hand and stamping you with it. Like, this, I'm good now.
In other words, humility, being humble.
Yeah.
In your strength.
Yeah.
And when you're not strong, remember that you are in him.
Exactly.
But when you are above and everything is going 200%, then you still have to have that. An attitude of humility.
Right.
So that you know it's not me, but you.
And it's really interesting that in our parasha, they connected both of these, Habakkuk and Amos. Because Amos is giving his prophecy at a time of economic flourishing. And Habakkuk is saying these words at a low point. And in either point, the dominant word is, you have to be dependent on God. So don't interpret, you know, the fact that you have all this blessing as you're blessed by God. Because he can reverse it to prove otherwise. The important part is whether you're in the height of blessing or in the lowness of famine or depression or whatever it is, that you're dependent on God, and he's ultimately the one who's going to sustain you. Mm. Nothing you have is going to do anything.
The message isn't you're a great nation because you have such great culture and mm-hmm. such great cultural accomplishments.
Right.
And we can rely on our the feats that we have and innovations and revolutions that we have done to carry us forward into the next century, like so many nations
right.
in history and to this day do. It's always that, don't rely on the fact that you think that you're a special nation.
Yeah.
You have to keep coming back to the fact that, culturally you may think that you have all kinds of great things, but that's not what is going to keep you safe. Either
right.
against your
There's
enemies
no guarantee.
Or, going to carry you through.
So in a sense, these two, by putting these passages together, these are actually giving you more interpretation on these words. So yes, be strong and courageous, but remember, in your trying to be strong and courageous, you're not actually just trying to trump up yourself. To be strong and courageous is really just to acknowledge that God is strong. And so you can be courageous because you're dependent on him. So you see kind of that interpretation going on when you read all of these together. I think, we are definitely out of time. If no one has any final thoughts, I'll just say Shabbat Shalom. The service is starting
Thank
downstairs.
You so much. Thank you.